From Minnesota to Georgia, Oregon to Arkansas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, anytime a firearm is used to commit a crime, it is big news. But you rarely hear about the times a firearm is used to prevent a crime. Amy Swearer from the Heritage Foundation is here to talk about the defensive use of firearms. Republicans scored two big wins in special congressional elections this past week, including flipping a California seat for the first time in decades. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Was the Center for Disease Control prepared for the coronavirus outbreak? An analysis of their budget says they were not. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Michelle Minton of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And it is a delicate balance. A national leader must project optimism while at the same time being realistic. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explores the challenge on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Anytime a gun is used to commit a crime, it makes the news. But every day, lawful gun owners use their weapons to defend themselves and to prevent crimes from happening. The Heritage Foundation has developed a database to track the defensive use of firearms. Here with details is Amy Swearer. Amy is a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Amy, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Amy, the Defensive Gun Use Database, tell us what it is you are attempting to measure with this database.
So it's rough that we're trying to accurately measure defensive gun uses in the United States, because that would be almost an impossible task. There's good reason to believe that most of these defensive gun uses, and the CDC, when it looked at a bunch of studies on this, thinks that there's probably between 500,000 and 3 million times that this happens every year. We couldn't possibly measure those. Most of those aren't actually reported to police, much less publicized in the media, so that there's some sort of public verification of it. But what we're really trying to do was give voice to these public stories that so often don't make it past from local news outlets, to sort of show people, look, even when we just narrow this down to the more, newsworthy stories where shots are fired or there's a police report filed or something of that nature where we can verify it, even when we just look at those stories, we're seeing hundreds and hundreds of these every year that are coming from law-abiding gun owners who didn't go looking for trouble. It just, they happened to be prepared when trouble found them. And these are happening to normal people living in our neighborhoods, on our streets, living our lives, very similar lives to us. And so we wanted to give sort of publicity on a national cohesive scale to these stories that I think so many people miss. They're not paying attention to the 30-second news snippet that might be up that night.
We, of course, always hear if somebody uses a gun for illegal purposes, whether it be a mass shooting or whether it be a gun used in the commission of a crime. So this database, are you able to uncover specific stories of where an individual had been able to use a weapon for personal protection and or to go out and prevent another person from being criminalized?
That's really the essence of all of these stories is gun owners defending themselves, but then also playing an important role in public safety generally. I can think of stories even just from the past 90 days where the real story wasn't necessarily what happened, but what was prevented from happening, where we can see quite clearly instances where what would have been mass public shootings, stories that would have stayed in the news for weeks at a time, that would have been quite horrific, were almost certainly prevented because of concealed carry permit holders and law-abiding citizens who just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And again, that's really what we want to emphasize here are sort of the non-stories, the things that don't happen, the horrors that are prevented and the tragedies that are stopped, and to give just a voice to those stories.
Can you give us an example, a story that sticks out in your mind of where a weapon was used for defensive purposes and it prevented a crime or a major tragedy from occurring?
Sure. Well, I can think of one even just from the past couple of weeks that I already kind of hinted at, but from out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, there was an instance where it seems that what would have been a mass public shooting was prevented, that there was a woman who got into an altercation at a shopping center, you know, got into a fight with some customers, left angry, and then a few minutes later came back and just started shooting randomly at shoppers in the parking lot. And fortunately, before anyone else was injured, any innocent bystanders were injured, there was a man with a concealed carry permit who drew his own weapon and ended that threat before, you know, this became this sort of national tragedy. So instead, it was just sort of a temporary local news story, but it prevented what would have been this big scale tragedy in the public eye.
You, of course, continue to track all things related to the use of weapons and guns and gun control in the various states. We see, Amy, all the time in the media where they're reporting the statistics of the number of crimes that guns are used to commit. I can't recall of a time when anybody's done something like this, where you have gone out and cataloged, quantified, where guns have been used for the defensive purpose that they are designed for. Is this something totally unique that you all have done?
The idea itself of having an interactive map is not necessarily unique, but I think you're right in suggesting that most of the time, these sorts of endeavors are undertaken to sort of show how guns are used incorrectly, to map tragedies. Part of this was we wanted to make sure that people knew that there was a counterbalance to this, that there's another side to the story, that it's not just guns being used in a criminal, unlawful, tragic manner, but that we are seeing stories hundreds and hundreds of times, even just from publicly available sources, where these are being used to save lives, to protect individual liberties, to protect public safety. And again, we can't really undertake to quantify that just with these stories, because so many of them are not reported, because it's a non-story, because nothing tragic really happened. So it's less about quantifying it and more just being able to meaningfully push back against it, even with just the small number of verified stories.
Does this also speak to the need, Amy, for gun owners to go out and get training so that they know how to properly use a weapon and be prepared when something of this sort happens? Because when you need to defend yourself with a gun, generally speaking, you have seconds or less than seconds to make a decision as to what to do. So is it important to have some advanced training if you are a gun owner?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is something that is especially important. As I think many people are aware right now, there are a lot of first-time gun owners just from the last month or so, with people who are concerned about COVID-19, some of the issues with police departments being decimated and not being able to respond necessarily in the same manner as they normally are. And especially for first-time gun owners, but for all gun owners generally, it is always so, so important to invest in not just responsible gun ownership, but in knowing how to handle your firearm properly. The last thing you want is that the first time or one of the first times you're handling your gun or having to fire it is when your life is on the line or when other people's lives are on the line. All of these gun owners that we're highlighting here, they were people who were able to, because of their training or because of the time and the effort that they put in to being responsible gun owners, were able to step up and use their guns in a responsible way. And it's harder to do that. It's harder to make those responsible split-second decisions. And you're more likely to injure innocent bystanders if you're not investing in training on your own, making sure that you understand how firearms work and how your specific firearm works.
Amy Swearer is a Heritage Legal Fellow. We've been talking about the Defensive Gun Use Database. Amy, tell us a bit about Heritage and where can folks go if they would like to access the interactive map that you have put together that reflects this database?
The Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank. We're dedicated to defending conservative principles. And if you want to check out this interactive database, you can go to heritage.org or simply Google Defensive Gun Use Database from the Heritage Foundation. That should take you right to us as well.
Amy Swearer of the Heritage Foundation. Amy, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson is with the Club for Growth, and in addition to keeping track of what's been happening in the nation's capital, he also tracks political developments around the country, of which there have been some significant ones this past week. So, Scott, good to have you back with us.
Great to be back, Loman.
Let's talk, first of all, two special congressional elections. They are relatively rare, often viewed as bellwethers in Wisconsin and California. Tell us a bit about the results.
Yeah, well, let's start out with the easy one. In Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District, last fall in September, Sean Duffy went ahead and had an early retirement. He had some family issues with a newborn, having some medical issues. So he stepped away and it created this special election. There was a competitive primary, and Tom Tiffany was a state senator. He was also endorsed by the Club for Growth Political Action Committee. And Tom Tiffany won the primary by about 15 points. This week, he also won the special election by about 15 points. And we're really excited that he'll be joining a solid group of conservatives that believe in economic freedom and liberty in the House of Representatives. The bigger story in many ways in terms of the political landscape in America is what happened in the 25th Congressional District in California. There you had a state lawmaker, that Christy Smith, that was really dubbed sort of this Sacramento candidate. And she was running against somebody with no voting record, a guy named Mike Garcia. He was a former fighter pilot of F-18s and an executive at Raytheon, and also was opposed by the Republican establishment in the Republican primary on Super Tuesday, March 3rd. It's a race where the top two finishers in California advanced to a special election, and that ended up being Christy Smith and Mike Garcia. So Garcia ended up flipping that seat. She did concede the race to him. I think in the end it'll be probably a high single digits margin of victory for Mike Garcia.
So that's good news on the House front. The big battle for control this November is going to be over in the U.S. Senate, where Republicans hold a very slim majority. Can you give us just a snapshot of how it looks at this point as we head close to the Memorial Day weekend?
When you look at the Senate landscape, right now the Republican majority is 53-45 with two independent Democrats caucusing with the Democratic caucus. So it's really a 53-47 majority, three-seat majority with Mike Pence casting tie-breaking votes. And we know that we've got our hands full in several seats. Right at the top of the list is Colorado with Cory Gardner's reelection campaign. You also have Martha McSally down in Arizona. Now that we've got Governor Bullock running in Montana, that makes the Montana race a very, very important and tight race. And Steve Daines has done a really good job, I think. But when you're running against the governor and you're a United States senator, you know that it's going to be close. And then you also got down in North Carolina, Tom Tillis is not looking great in his prospects for reelection right now. North Carolina is going to be a tough seat, and it's also a tough state for the president's reelection. So those four seats right there are, hopefully we can win them and maintain the Senate majority. Right now, Republicans are looking at one pickup opportunity in Alabama against Democrat incumbent Doug Jones. Republicans continue a pretty competitive primary between former Attorney General and United States Senator Jeff Sessions, taking on former Auburn head coach and the football team, Tommy Tuberville. Tuberville has been endorsed by the President of the United States. And obviously, Sessions has a little bit of baggage with everything that happened during his tenure as Attorney General. Republicans also hope that they could have a shot at winning back the Michigan seat, but you know, that's one we've been chasing for a while. They think that there's a strong candidate with John James running against Gary Peters, but think that if we're being realistic right now, there's really one solid pickup opportunity for Republicans. There's a second one in Michigan here that is a stretch, but Democrats have a pretty favorable map to winning the majority by a slight margin. So the stakes are high. The stakes are judicial nominations. The stakes are the next Supreme Court justice. The stakes are what happens with carbon tax, with gun control. The legislative filibuster could easily be eliminated when Democrats have unified government. And if they lose the majority in the Senate, and if President Trump doesn't win re-election, Democrats will run roughshod over Republicans for 2 years until the 2022 midterm.
We, of course, will continue to track the Senate races as we go through this election year. Turning back to Washington, D.C., Nancy Pelosi wants a $3 trillion stimulus, quote, stimulus plan. Any real chance for that?
Look, it's a 1,800-page long progressive wish list with no Republican input and no chance it becoming law. The Senate has already said that they won't even take it up for a vote. The estimated cost, yeah, it's $3 trillion. You've got the blue state bailout, $1 trillion to state and local governments. You're extending unemployment insurance benefits of the $600 benefit through the federal government through January. Unlimited borrowing authority for D.C., $25 billion for the post office, eliminating changes that we made in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act related to subsidizing high-tax states through the state and local tax deduction. You've got a second round of direct payments. You've got expanding the rebate checks to illegal immigrants and changing the eligibility requirements. You've got $175 billion for rent, mortgages, and utilities, increasing benefits for food stamps. They're also doing a universal vote by mail through the legislation. This is just a progressive wish list. It is not a real act of legislating.
We'll continue to keep an eye on that. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington. Your listeners can check us out on our website at clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Thanks.
Follow the money. If you do, it doesn't look like the Center for Disease Control was prepared to handle a pandemic. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Michelle Minton of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Over the past 3 decades, the Centers for Disease Control has seen its taxpayer-funded budget doubled, then doubled again, then doubled again, and then nearly doubled once again. Despite all that money, though, the CDC seems to have failed disastrously at its primary task of protecting Americans from infectious diseases. And a new report from the Competitive Enterprise Institute says that mission creep and poor priority setting are to blame. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Michelle Minton. She's a friend of mine and also a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the author of this new report, which you can find at CEI.org. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Eric.
We are spending nearly 14 times as much on the CDC as we did in 1987, Michelle. That means the CDC's budget has grown 3 times faster than the federal government's overall spending total in the last 33 years. But I don't feel like I'm getting a return on that money right now.
Yeah, no, it's not like fixing potholes or something like useful like that. The CDC continues to go hat in hand to Congress every chance they get to say, we need more money every time there's a crisis, yet every subsequent crisis, they don't seem to have done with that money what would be effective in, you know, preventing people from dying.
Yeah, and that was the original purpose for the CDC, right? I mean, it was created to prepare the country for situations exactly like the one that we are currently facing.
Right. I mean, in the very beginning, its mission was incredibly limited. It was a part of the World War II effort, and it was its whole thing was to stop the spread of malaria, which was getting in the way of a war effort. And then after malaria was under control and the war ended, once you set up a government agency and you get a bunch of money and they hire a bunch of people, they're not just going to shut down. And CDC over the years has been very good at using whatever seems to be the most scary thing, the thing that's going to open the most wallets for them. And in the last couple of decades, that's been what we call chronic diseases. First they move from malaria to other infectious diseases, and those are all important things, mind you. But then they started moving to things like obesity and diabetes and now vaping. And a lot of times it's not just them glomming onto something that the public's scared about. They actually do a lot of work to make sure that we're scared about it, to make sure Congress knows that it's an epidemic, the use of the word epidemic is an epidemic.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, you mentioned vaping there, and I think that's really the best example of this this mission creep from the CDC. I know it's difficult to remember anything that happened before the coronavirus times, but if you go back 6 months, 9 months ago, the CDC was all worked up about vaping. And look, there were some deaths caused by people using black market e-cigarettes. There was a bit of a medical crisis there. But the CDC was acting like this was some sort of global health problem, when in fact, there was actually a global health crisis that was about to hit.
The vaping lung injuries that occurred last summer are a perfect example of what is wrong, I think, with our health agencies. It actually started even before that with the Food and Drug Administration, started to drum up fear about this idea of seizures related to e-cigarettes. There's been, I think, 20 in the last 15 years, and they started putting out notices saying, let us know if you've had one, which it's important for people to report adverse events that may or may not be related to products to FDA, but it had the effect, and I think it was an intentional effect, of making people think e-cigarettes were causing or potentially causing seizures, even though there's loads of people with seizure disorders and a lot of people use e-cigarettes. It's just, it's going to happen that those two things will occur at the same time. Anyway, that didn't really go anywhere for FDA. It got a couple of news reports. And then this E-Valley thing started, what they call E-Valley e-cigarette or vaping-associated lung injury, where a bunch of kids, but it started in the Midwest, started showing up at hospitals with acute lung failure, really serious problems. And I think that started in June or July. And in July, I called it and said, this is not related to vaping. It's related to vaping illegal drugs, specifically marijuana, because most of the reports when the kids were interviewed, and it was mostly young people, they said that they've been using marijuana. They didn't always admit it, but most of the time they did. And then by the next month after that, it was even more clear. States started testing THC vaporizers and were finding adulterated ingredients. They were finding vitamin E acetate. States started warning people that they shouldn't buy these THC vaporizers off the black market, and they started talking about vitamin E. FDA even started doing that, and it wasn't until, I think, about January that CDC tacitly admitted that THC might be involved. They kept, you know, even the name E-Valley, e-cigarette and vaping associated. They put e-cigarettes at the front and kept talking about it to scare the public, and it worked. A lot of people, even to this day, don't know that those lung injuries were 100% caused by black market THC products. You know, a few people, the CDC kept saying, oh, but there's some cases where they're not telling us that they were using marijuana. Well, I mean, a lot of those they're in states where it's not legal, or they did get them illegally. That's not something you're going to necessarily admit to a government agency.
Yeah, and of course, encouraging people not to use e-cigarettes means that they're probably more likely to use traditional cigarettes, which are worse for you, and there's all sorts of negative public health outcomes there. Just a total mess. We are talking with Michelle Minton from the Competitive Enterprise Institute about the CDC. Just about a minute left here, Michelle. Tell me what should be done when this crisis passes. How do we make sure the CDC can continue to do its essential functions, can focus on those essential functions without getting distracted by all this other stuff?
Congress needs to step in. I mean, I think it's good that we're going to be looking into the World Health Organization. They have a lot of the same problems, but really going off mission and focusing on controlling people's lifestyle behaviors instead of infectious diseases that will kill them immediately. Congress needs to go in and start directing the CDC where it can and cannot use its money. For example, it shouldn't be using, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to promote anti-vaping fear, or maybe it should pare back some of its obesity stuff. Leave that to the other agencies that, you know, like the NIH, National Institutes of Health. There's a lot of overlap in what they do. The NIH has a lot of money to spend on research. CDC should be made to focus, since they're not going to do it on its own, made to focus on infectious and contagious diseases.
Couldn't have said it better. We are unfortunately out of time for today, though. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, that is Michelle Minton, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can check out her new report on the CDC's budget and mission creep issues at CEI.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
For a national leader during times of crisis, it is a fine line to walk. He or she must uplift the spirits of the nation while at the same time being realistic about the challenge. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA talks about it on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary.
One of the many effects of the COVID-19 shutdown for me has been many more hours spent on my computer just nosing around the internet, following tangents that lead to more tangents, and so on. I am by nature an optimist. I think that optimistic people generally have more satisfying lives, but I also believe that optimism is an important leadership characteristic. Even though as great a leader as Winston Churchill struggled from time to time with depression, as a leader, he always managed to convey optimism. When he said things like, "Give us the tools and we will finish the job," and "We shall never surrender," and "This was England's finest hour," he stirred the heart of a nation that could very easily have collapsed and allowed Nazi Germany and its superior weapons of war to overrun it. Churchill was a leader who understood the power of optimism. Contrast that to President Jimmy Carter, who famously suggested that the American people were suffering a crisis in confidence in a speech that was so depressing that it became known as his malaise speech, although that word was never employed in the speech itself. That speech may have contributed to his defeat every bit as much as Churchill's words contributed to Britain's victory. Mulling over the essence of optimism led me to a psychological website called exploringyourmind.com, where I found this. Optimistic people tend to suffer fewer depressive problems. Apparently, optimism helps protect us from developing the hopeless point of view that is characteristic of depression. It softens the blow of the impact caused by difficulties. At the same time, it helps us see ourselves as people who are more capable of facing conflicts and overcoming suffering. Apparently, optimism helps us when it comes time to face stressful situations and offsets the harmful effects of stress on our health. Well, that certainly seems pertinent to our current predicament. A leader who can engender a spirit of optimism among the people he or she leads can not only have a material and positive effect on the national mood during stress, but also may actually cause a positive effect on the eventual outcome. How does an optimistic person behave? Back to the website. Optimists tend to expect positive results in their lives with a general belief that everything is going to be okay, although they may be going through tough times. Hoping that things will get better can definitely make our lives a little bit easier. On the other hand, there are limits to optimism. Exploring Your Mind says, we all know people who present themselves as very secure and brag about themselves. With their heads held high, they act like they know everything and that nobody will ever get up to their level. These people are known for their airs of superiority. They think they're better than everyone else. Modesty is not a feature that characterizes these people. They always act proud and stuck up over everything that might make them stand out above the rest. Could this just be a mask hiding a deep complex? Think of people who bully others. They're not as strong as they seem because they need to harm others to instill fear and command respect. But inside, they're not as brave as they seem. They have serious problems that they hide and project onto the people around them. Human beings have a great capacity for denying the problems that surround them. And sometimes, even when they see reality right in front of their eyes, they still have the audacity to deny it. In the case of people with airs of superiority, their biggest problem is the insecurity that haunts them. People with airs of superiority mask their insecurity by acting superior to others and humiliating them so that they can feel better about themselves. Close quote from Exploring Your Mind. Interesting, isn't it? And relevant? You decide. But either way, I appreciate your giving me some time to share the kind of web crawling I've been doing during the shutdown. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WTIM-AM in Somerville, Massachusetts, WXMC-AM in Troy Hills, New Jersey, along with WOLD-LP in Woodbridge, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.